From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
La Playa.
I live in the Transmission.
Coming up, Mexican Americans watch the presidential elections. Not here, but south of the border.
Really, the election of the president is a referendum on who best can return Mexico to normal.
Then imagine a Bay Area with a population of 9 million people. What needs to change for it to work?
Can urban environments handle more people? And is that the least worst solution, assuming that there is going to be population growth?
And how to coexist with our fellow neighborhood critters.
It just kind of got up on its hind legs and stared at me. And so I was like, oh my God.
Raccoons! That's today on Cross Currents. States across the U.S. are gearing up for the presidential election in November. But other presidential elections worldwide are in the spotlight, too, including one very close to home.
For months, Enrique Peña Nieto has enjoyed a commanding lead in the polls. He's benefited from widespread discontent over the way President Felipe Calderón's PAN party has governed Mexico.
On July 1st, Mexicans will choose a new president. So far, the front runner against President Felipe Calderón is opposition leader Enrique Peña Nieto. Right now, polls show he has 42% support. On voting day, Americans will be watching, especially the millions of people who live along the border with a personal stake in the outcome. That's what a team of reporters discovered on trips to communities that straddle the line between the U.S. and Mexico. From the Frontera Reporting Project, Peter O'Dowd brings us this story.
Stand on the edge of this unfinished railroad bridge outside of Brownsville, Texas, and you can see across the Rio Grande into Mexico. It's the first bridge of its kind to connect the countries in a century. And for businessman John Wood, it's a symbol of the way lives connect along the border.
We are tied together. It's kind of like an umbilical cord.
Texas does more business with its southern neighbor than any other state, and that's a big reason why Wood says Mexico's upcoming election means as much to him as the battle between President Obama and Mitt Romney.
If Mexico isn't doing well, it doesn't seem to be a whole lot of difference what's happening in Washington.
Wood says the next president could help make Mexico well again. A more stable and calmer Mexico would mean more investment and more jobs in Brownsville.
A better life for not only me, but for everyone that lives in the area.
Some Americans along the border have a huge stake in Mexican politics. The Woodrow Wilson Center estimates the two countries traded a record $500 billion in goods and services last year. Investment fell off during the recession, but has steadily climbed back despite escalating drug violence. Analysts say business would strengthen even more if Mexico solved its cartel problem. That's absolutely right, according to Daniel Hong. He owns this general goods store a few yards from Brownsville's port. Hong says sales have dropped 60% in recent years, and it doesn't have much to do with the economy.
My clientele is mostly Mexican nationals. If they're afraid to leave their houses, I'm not going to have customers, simply put.
So Hong has an opinion on the election. On a personal level, he supports the National Action Party, or the PAN, and the continuation of President Felipe Calderón's drug war offensive. But on the business level, he supports the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, ran Mexico for 70 years and kept relative peace by turning a blind eye to the cartels.
They will give, you know, the northern Mexico states a little bit more calm, a little bit more tranquility, and that leads to more people coming over, which leads to more sales.
And that is the heart of this election, according to Tony Zavaleta. He directs the Center for Border and Transnational Studies at the University of Texas, Brownsville.
Really, the election of the president is a referendum on who best can return Mexico to normal.
Zavaleta says normalcy is important to the psyche of the entire border community. It's not just businesses with ties to both countries. It's Americans like him who see Mexico as a second home, as a place where friends and family live.
We live with one foot in each country all the time. I know it can get better. We have to hope that this election will set it on the right track to getting better.
More than 1,000 miles to the west in Nogales, Arizona, a line of commercial trucks rumbles toward the international port. Last year, nearly 5 billion pounds of grapes, peppers, tomatoes, and other fresh produce moved through here. Some of it belonged to Gerardo Ritz. His family owns farms in Sinaloa. Ritz runs the business side from Arizona. With literally a foot in both worlds, Ritz also closely watches the security debate in Mexico.
It's something that makes our business pretty much sustain business and keeps us as an American entity investing in Mexico.
Ritz says military checkpoints on Mexican highways keep his produce safe on its journey north. He credits Calderon's offensive against the cartels, and he expects Mexico's next president to keep it up.
We don't want to see organized crime getting into the produce business. In my opinion, whoever runs the country for the next 6 years has got to continue.
As a Mexican national, Ritz won't say which candidate he'll vote for July 1st, but on Election Day, he'll be like many others in the U.S., looking south toward Mexico.
That's reporter Peter O'Dowd from the Fronteras Public Radio Reporting Project. So, do you follow elections in another country too? Which one means the most to you? Leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Potential new governments always promise change, and political challengers like to focus on how things would be different, that is, better, if they were elected. It's the ultimate campaign promise: a better city, county, state, a better country, less struggle, more prosperity and growth. Here in the Bay Area, growth has a very literal meaning. We have a growing population, and especially in San Francisco, limited space. So what kind of growth will we see? Suburban sprawl? How about condos, strip malls, and big box stores? Many development experts argue that not all growth is good for a given place. Instead of just growth, that we should be aiming for smart growth. That's the question a number of local journalists tackled in the latest edition of the SF Public Press. It published a special report titled Growing Smarter, Planning for a Bay Area of 9 Million. It's produced in collaboration with Cage Lab at UC Berkeley's Geography Department, Earth Island Journal, and Bay Nature Magazine. The series explores the economic, environmental, and human impact of a future population boom in the Bay Area, including a report titled Can San Francisco add 150,000 more people? Michael Stoll is executive director of the SF Public Press. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney about smart growth in the Bay.
The urban core, San Francisco, Oakland, you know, both sides of the inner ring of the Bay Area, have pretty much been built out. And in the last couple of decades, development has happened over the hills in the East Bay, in the south near San Jose. And as a result, people are driving a lot more and a lot farther than they ever have. The idea behind these regional efforts to control sprawl is to get people out of their cars, or at least accommodate the expected population growth that's going to come in the next few decades in more compact communities that more resemble the inner ring urban environments like San Francisco and Oakland. One of the ways of doing that is urban infill development, so identifying the spaces in already established cities that have the infrastructure, that have the public transit, and putting more development in there, encouraging developers to build in cities again as they did, you know, more than 50 years ago. It's also to build what are called transit villages. A lot of BART stations have nothing around them, the more far-flung ones. The idea is if you build housing and jobs around those BART stations, you're going to increase the likelihood that people aren't even going to drive to park and drive to go down to San Francisco to go to their job. They'll just walk to the BART station, or they may get on the BART, take it to a job center, and go to their job, and they may never have to get in their car. This is all part of a regional environmental strategy that comes from the state climate change laws from 2008, which required California to reduce carbon emissions from automobiles by 15% by 2035. That's the law, easier said than done. and it falls to these regional government agencies, most of which no one has ever heard of in the Bay Area, to come up with a master plan to get people out of their cars, change where they live, and really re-engineer the social fabric and the physical layout of the Bay Area.
That's Michael Stoll. He's editor of the San Francisco Public Press, which has a new edition out about sprawl and the way in which governments are trying to change the patterns in which people live. What are some of the articles that you've put together in this edition that are looking at this from different angles?
We have a story from Maureen Mitra. She's the managing editor of Earth Island Journal.
And Maureen Nandini Mitra was a volunteer here at KALW.
She was. She's a multi-talented producer, editor, and now newspaper journalist.
So tell me about her story.
So Maureen took a fascinating look at the rarefied world of demographers. The state, regional agencies, and a bunch of private think tanks and universities all have their own methodology for measuring not only current population, but also predicting future population. And this is a big deal because if the population projections are too high, communities will be spending a lot more money trying to prepare for growth that may not happen.
So what are the different population projections? I mean, what competing numbers are we looking at here?
Okay. So the current 2010 census says the Bay Area has 7.2 million people. The State Department of Finance made a projection that in 2040, the population of the Bay Area would be about 9.5 million people. They recently reduced that based on some new data about the economics of the Bay Area, job creation, to 8.4. And that's a huge difference.
That just cut a million off the top.
They, you know, the economy is changing so rapidly, and economists have gotten into this as well. You need the economics in order to figure out how many people are going to be coming to the Bay Area to be attracted to jobs in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. You have to imagine what industries are going to be leading then, what are going to be the housing needs, who's going to want to live where, how much demand will there be for this smart growth that planners want to build in transit villages and in the urban core. There are a lot of moving pieces, and the science of demography is anything but. It's a very imprecise science.
That's Michael Stoll. He's editor of the San Francisco Public Press with a new edition out about sprawl. Tell me about another story in that.
One of the stories on the front cover of the special section is about the carrying capacity of San Francisco and the Bay Area. So the writer is Allison Hawks, who is one of the editors at Bay Nature magazine. She took a look at the old argument going back to Paul Ehrlich, who's a professor of population studies at Stanford, that at some point the population explosion was going to start degrading the natural environment and reducing availability of resources. And that's spawned a whole kind of cottage industry of environmental predictions about how population interacts with the environment. Some environmentalists and some urban planners say cities are the best place to put a growing population because they already have the infrastructure. They already have transportation networks, electricity, sewer systems. Everything is set up to be very flexible in turn. You can squeeze another 25% or another 20% of people in San Francisco and not feel it as much as going out into the green fields of East Contra Costa County and building whole new neighborhoods and cities. You need to lay the sewer lines. You need to build roads. It's all very expensive and it's environmentally destructive. Others say, actually, no, maybe we should think about limiting growth even in the cities because there are infrastructure concerns. And at a certain point, you're going to produce so much pollution, you know, just from all of the toilets being flushed in San Francisco, the sewage going out into the ocean, and that is going to produce environmental harm. So there's a question of, can urban environments handle more people? And is that the least worst solution, assuming that there is going to be population growth? All of these stories are very complex, very controversial. But it all comes down to the idea that we are going to grow. The population of the United States is growing. The population of the world is growing. There's immigration. There's legal and illegal immigration. There's no way to stop it. The question is, what influence can we have over future population growth, and what are we going to do about it? Are we going to do the business as usual development, putting people farther and farther out and letting developers grab up land further and further into this undeveloped territory or what's left of it around the Bay Area? Or are we going to take advantage of the resources that already exist in the urban core and bolster them and create more communities that look like downtown San Francisco or Oakland with a vibrant social life where you don't have to get into your car to go to the grocery store?
Michael Stoll is executive director of the SF Public Press. He spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney about the press's latest edition, which includes a special report entitled Growing Smarter, Planning for a Bay Area of 9 Million. You can find a link to that report, hear this and other interviews, all online at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. For urban planning to be smart, it should be designed to accommodate not only humans, but also our friends in nature who inhabit the land alongside us. You don't have to be outside for long to realize that here in the Bay Area, we're surrounded by wildlife. Long before houses and roads and cities popped up, wild animals reigned supreme. As we negotiate our relationship to the remaining members of that wild life, there's bound to be some tension. One particularly sneaky animal is on the prowl in almost every neighborhood, digging up garden beds, living in attics, scavenging through garbage. Yep, you know them. They're raccoons, one of the most common urban animals in America. But just because they're everywhere doesn't mean our relationships with them are peaceful. Reporter Hadley Robinson has more.
If you've ever walked through a campground at night, you might have had this experience. You shine a flashlight into the woods and see glowing, beady eyes staring back at you. Haven't had that happen while camping? Well, you don't need to go far. Shine your lights in a sewer drain in the Bay Area, and you'll likely catch a glimpse of those same flashing eyes. Though raccoons are common in cities, people's opinions of them vary wildly.
Cute.
Ferocious.
Very playful.
Annoying.
Did you hear? Annoying? That's how Dan Ryan describes the 10 to 20 pound nocturnal creatures. He's been battling them for years in his Oakland home. First, he found a family living in his walls.
You know, you get in your head that this thing is out there, and you get kind of paranoid about it. And you start feeling like it's me against the raccoons, and they're out to get me. And so you start then cooking up little solutions in your head, whether it be calling the exterminator guy or buy an electric fence or secretly designing weapons in your head.
Ryan and the wildlife removal company tried everything they could think of to evict the raccoons from the attic, patching holes in the roof, various chemical repellents, even spraying with coyote urine.
And I found that kind of get very medieval because it really is sort of like you versus the dark forces. And then, of course, the fact that they're masked and they're at night, of course, helps that imagery.
Ryan ended up with a raccoon-free attic. But then his backyard grapes started to go. So we called the same wildlife removal company to trap and remove the animals. The removal team came, set up a cage, and baited it with Fig Newtons. After first catching a baby skunk by accident, they snared a raccoon.
Great, they come and they get the raccoon. And they leave the cage out, just in case there's another one. And we catch another raccoon. And the next day, we catch another raccoon. And this kind of just went on to the point where we caught, I think in the end, 10 or 12 raccoons. And spent a ton of money disposing of them all.
Since there are limits on where captured raccoons can be released, the animals from Ryan's yard were all euthanized. But his raccoon problems aren't over. This year, grape splotches are all over the ground again. So Ryan has a new plan. He's installed a small electric fence around his grapevines.
I think they went from being cute to being annoying. And then there was a period where they went, it was a pretty visceral, they are my enemy. There were times when I would say to Jillian, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get a spear and I'm going to attack them. And she was like, no, you can't get a spear. And of course, I really wasn't going to. But that was what it felt like. I just wanted to find something that would give me my edge over them because they clearly had gotten the edge over me.
Dan Ryan is the type of person Jamie Ray likes to talk to. Ray lives in San Francisco, and she's the person Animal Control will refer you to if you're having problems with animals in your house or yard. She was the one who described raccoons as playful and curious.
Pretty much all the calls have to do with seasonal behaviors. Things that are just natural behaviors for wildlife. And, people sometimes take it personally and think that they're intentionally trying to bother them, but it's not. It's just a natural behavior.
Ray thinks raccoons deserve to live among us, and she's not just saying that. She's the only person in San Francisco with a permit to rehabilitate orphaned or injured mammals. There's no wildlife hospital.
I found that quite astounding that we have, 100 clinics for cats and dogs and domestic animals and nothing for, no place where native animals can get medical care when they need it.
So the place has become Ray's outer Richmond home. She rehabilitates the injured ones, and the orphaned ones go in foster homes, where people are trained to take care of them. I asked her what she has right now.
A little raccoon who was hit by a car, the skunk with his foot snapped in the rat trap, a opossum with an eye infection, another opossum with a jaw injury. We rehabilitate them for release back to the wild. We have a pretty good success rate with rehabilitating them and releasing them back, giving them that chance to live.
And when you say back to the wild, you're talking about back to where you found them somewhere in the city.
Exactly, to their natural environment.
Ray says that raccoons are very afraid of humans and don't like to get close. But San Francisco resident Tegwin Lewis Pine has to disagree. She recently got extremely close to one while walking her dog at the Palace of Fine Arts. Yeah, she's the one who used the word ferocious.
We were walking and saw this raccoon sort of standing there, and my immediate thought was, okay, gotta scare the raccoon. So ran towards it, and as I ran towards it, it just kind of got up on its hind legs and stared at me. And so I was like, oh my God.
Lewis Pine was unsettled. In all her past experiences with raccoons, they'd run away when frightened. Her dog Athena started sniffing around where the raccoon had appeared.
The raccoon came out in full-fledged attack mode, growling and hissing. And as soon as I saw it attacking my dog, Athena, and on her nose, I started kicking at it to try and get it to go away. And I kicked it and kicked it and kicked it.
She says she started tugging on Athena's leash, trying to get out of there.
And as I was pulling her away and as I was kicking, I fell backwards in the process and was on the ground, continuing to kick at the raccoon. And then as I was on the ground and kicking, at some point in that scuffle, the raccoon came over and scratched my knee and bit my leg through my jeans, bit my inner thigh.
She says the rest is hard to remember, but at some point she and her dog ran away and went to their respective emergency rooms for rabies shots. Reginald Barrett, a professor of wildlife management at UC Berkeley, says that was probably a wise move.
I think it's probably not such a good thing to have wild animals habituated. Generally, the closer the contact humans have with wild animals, the more chance you have of transmitting diseases, getting bitten. Even squirrels will bite. Wild animals are wild.
Barrett had a few ideas for how to minimize contact.
If you don't want raccoons around, it probably helps to harass them a bit. They have to learn that they're not wanted.
But that was before I told him Lewis Pine's story.
That seems pretty abnormal to me. I worry about the rabies thing. Rabies is still around. It's with us. And if you have wild animals that are charging you or chasing you and trying to bite you, that's really bad. You don't want to be around when that's happening.
We'll never know what got into that raccoon. There's some chance it could have been rabid, or maybe, like the squirrels or pigeons who get too close for comfort in urban areas, they're just used to us. Lewis Pine, for her part, is done trying to scare them out of her way.
I certainly have a increased respect for, I think, raccoons, but also just all wildlife, renewed sense of live and let live. And if they're not really involved in what I'm doing, then I'm going to even more stay away.
And if you're out walking late at night, you might want to keep an eye on those sewer drains. For Cross Currents, I'm Hadley Robinson.
So what critters do you encounter in your neighborhood, and how do you deal with them? Let us know on our Facebook page. It's KALW News. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Buffy Almendares, Zoe Bresny, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Nina Gensler-Debs, Lupe Hernandez, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, RTM's Conhoffs, Holly J. McDeed, Erica Mu, Nina Nicole Morente, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, and Isaac Silk. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.